Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
We've shown all along the way that we're not going to pull our punches, whether it's on solar winds or election interference or Navalny.
Engage and hold to account. What next for Russia and America after the Biden-Putin summit? My exclusive interview with the Russian ambassador to the UK. And
I never had a doubt, not one day, that we were not going to win this.
The race to be New York City's next mayor, the top candidates, and why this election matters for the country. Plus, conservative thinker George Will tells Walter Isaacson why he broke with the party of Trump and what the sleeper issue could be in the 2022 elections.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. When it comes to reframing the U.S.-Russia relationship, President Biden said the proof would be in the eating of the pudding. So it's been nearly a week since his Geneva summit with President Putin, and already their respective ambassadors are returning to their posts. President Biden is feeling hopeful, according to some of his aides, that Putin could change course from constantly undermining the Western allies. But let us not celebrate rapprochement just yet. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in Europe as Washington says is preparing a whole new raft of sanctions, this time for the nerve agent attack on the opposition leader Alexei Navalny. And the Kremlin says it doesn't think Washington will stop trying to contain Russia. So what does this post-summit environment look like from Moscow? Joining me for an exclusive interview is Russia's ambassador to the UK, Andrei Kellin. Ambassador, welcome back to our program. So let me ask you, you know, President Putin called the meeting with President Biden professional. He called it constructive. So how are you and Moscow assessing the U.S. or Russia-Western relationship right now?
Okay, thank you for this very good question, of course. It is not a secret that in the recent months, tension has arisen in Europe, and not only in political statements, but also in deeds. We from Moscow, we have seen quite a lot of movement of NATO troops close to our borders. It was called maneuvers Defender Europe. The troops were moving in the north as well, in Baltic Sea. We have seen many NATO ships in the Black Sea as well. So not only Baltics, but all along our borders, we have seen that tension has increased. Of course, we moved some troops as well, which has been taken as a bad step. Now, there was a summit. Summit was conducted constructively, as both presidents has recognized. So what has happened? First, there was a statement that we were waiting for, stated about nuclear weapons, and it is said that nuclear war cannot be won, and it has never must be fought. It's a very important conclusion because for quite some time we had certain doubts that it is realistic and administration stick to this principle. So second good statement after prolongation of START treaty. And I think it is not yet a turning point, but it is a certain point in a rising tension. After that, we probably will need many more summits, not many, but perhaps some summits, in order to have a certain detente in this world of increasing tension.
Okay, so your tone seems fairly hopeful, certainly a lot less belligerent than many Russian officials when they address the current state of affairs. So I sense a kind of a shift, and it coincides with what President Putin, I'm just going to read what he's written in a German newspaper, Die Zeit, because today is the 80th anniversary, as I know you mark, in Russia, of Hitler's invasion of the USSR. And to mark that, Putin has said the whole system of European security is now degraded significantly. He said tensions are rising and the risks of a new arms race are becoming real, even though you have said you know, the statements on that are encouraging. But he says that prosperity and security in Europe can only happen through cooperation between Europe, the United States, and Russia. And he says Russia is in favor of restoring a comprehensive partnership with Europe. So from your perspective, what will Russia do to restore a comprehensive partnership that has been so badly damaged? You know, NATO called Russia a threat in its latest communique. What do you think you need to do to restore that partnership? And then we'll talk about the others.
Okay, first about this date. It is true, today it is 80th anniversary when Nazis invaded Soviet Union, and it is deep in our memory, I should say. It was a devastating war, of course. We have lost millions and millions of people. We continue still to count how many it is, and we will remember this forever. And the most important is that we will never allow that similar things will happen once again on the European continent or whenever in the world. And for this, we need to restore security in Europe. We need to restore security architecture, which was long desired by Europeans and the others. By now, it is true that this security architecture, all treaties, nearly all of them, has been abandoned and demolished. So we need to re-engage on that. We need to re-engage with the United States, and we start probably next month, I hope, talks on strategic stability. This strategic stability, it will be a prolongation of the START treaty, and I hope it will involve all components necessary for that. So it will be certainly a restart which might bring a good new relationship. Probably this is not very new, but some years ago we have already come to this relationship where we shall have whole Europe without dividing lines and secure.
So I want to ask you, because as you know, President Biden took a little bit of a risk by having this summit with President Putin. He's not very popular in Washington, and there was plenty in the chattering classes, in the political classes, who accused him of a bit of appeasement and of being naive for believing that Putin might change his stripes. Some of Biden's aides say that the president remains hopeful, that despite what's been going on over the last few years, the president, your president, will stop trying to undermine the Western alliance. Is President Biden right to be hopeful? Do you believe that that is on the agenda?
Well, I'm sure that threats that has been mentioned in different capitals, including London, are false. We are not threatening the West. We are not represent a threat to the countries. We would like to discuss these issues. For instance, in the recent months, we have seen many accusations about an attack in the cybersphere. Most of them, not most of them, but mainly, they were false because they are ungrounded. We would like to discuss these issues with facts on the table, and this is the only way to do this. By the way, while Putin was talking to Biden, he said that there were at least 50 demands last year and 20 this year from Washington to Moscow to explain these cyber threats, to which we responded positively, and we provided answers to all the issues. Unfortunately, U.S. does not respond to our questions, and they were nearly 40. So what is the outcome? It's just to establish a working group, expert session, and to discuss it with facts and not via media, not, well, via megaphone, accusing each other. It only revives tensions. So this is our approach, and we hope that in the coming months we will be able to do this directly with the United States as well as with the United Kingdom.
So you sound conciliatory again. It sounds like a shift in tone for sure. But the fact of the matter is, Ambassador, that not only the United States, Great Britain, but NATO believes that there would be no such cyber hacking. I mean, just take SolarWinds. Just take, you know, the thing that just, I mean, it affected so much of the U.S. infrastructure. They intelligence believes that that was either, you know, done by the Moscow government or sanctioned by it, by other players. They believe that hackers, that whoever they might be, often have sanction, whether it's turning a blind eye or direct encouragement from the government. This is what President Biden said about his discussion about cyber warfare with President Putin.
I pointed out to him we have significant cyber capability. And he knows it. He doesn't know exactly what it is, but it's significant. And if, in fact, they violate these basic norms, we will respond.
So that's pretty clear, Mr. Ambassador. That raises the possibility of retaliation.
In what you have said, you have at least three times said that certain people do believe in something. We, of course, also have many people that do believe in something. And this formulation, highly likely, it has arisen several years ago. And since at that time, it is being repeated, and some people would like to accuse Russia about everything bad what is happening in the world. This might, of course, continue, but we have similar suspicions. And we know also from the United States sources that the bulk of attack comes from United States territory, as well from the territory of Canada and the United Kingdom. But we are not making out of it a war. We suggest that we should professionally approach to this. Professionally meaning an expert talk and an expert explanation. And believe me, only in that way we will find the way how to beat it, how to contradict it, because no one would like attacks against each other's infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the meantime, despite President Biden's hope that there can be a different relationship going forward, the United States is preparing a new raft of sanctions because of the what they believe is the government-sanctioned nerve agent attack against your opposition leader, Alexei Navalny. So the idea from the United States is, sure, engage, but hold Russia to account. I mean, clearly that has to happen. And the question is, and they have a united Western, unified backing for this now. What will that affect Russia's calculations? You know, why does President Putin, use such heavy-handed methods against an opposition leader who he doesn't even deign to name?
I'm not in a position to comment on the judgment of the Russian court when this definition has been done. I can only refer you to the sentence that has been done. What Navalny and his company are doing, it is, they are trying to destabilize society. They are trying to undermine the constitutional order. It is clear. Elections. They are trying to set up hatred and hostilities in my country. And it is natural that the state is not very satisfied with this activity. We have to do something with that. What I am surprised with is such an attention to be given to one person who is not very popular at all in Russia. He is popular in the West, mainly in Europe, but he is not a politician. He is just assembling facts in order to assault ministers in our government, political parties that are supporting this government. And it is surprising for me. We, of course, can choose also some people, those who has tried to seize United States Congress and say our relations will depend on the fate of these people, but it will look ridiculous.
Yeah, well, the people who attacked the U.S. Congress were insurgents who have been, chased down by the FBI, will face prosecution. Navalny is an opposition leader. You may or may not like it, but he's the one who's brought out the most supporters, the biggest demonstrations ever in the history of opposition politics in your country. So basically what you're saying is that there's no tolerance for anything other than official opposition. And I just want to ask you to comment on what's just happened in Belarus. You know, fighter jets brought down a civilian aircraft that had permission to overfly the territory just because a journalist was on board. And today, there's been sanctions imposed. The Belarusian government has reacted furiously. But the point to you is, why would Moscow side with such a rogue operation? That's what I don't understand. Why? Especially as Putin is saying we have to be jointly responsible for geopolitical stability.
First, we have an opposition in the parliament, and these are three parties. You should not disregard this. It is a majority of the opposition. We have also opposition outside of the parliament, and it is also pretty organized opposition. And we have a small group of people that are supporting Navalny. You said that we have huge demonstration. These demonstrations were not in support of Navalny. They were handled by those young people, those paid people, also paid by the organization which is supporting Navalny. So it is complicated. Don't simplify all these things. Now, coming to Belarus, it is early to comment on what has happened. ICAO is conducting, International Aviation Organization is conducting a true investigation, and it's only up to them to make a judgment. The first results of this investigation will be revealed on the 25th of June, and I'm eager to see what has happened and in order to establish. Until this moment, until the conclusions will come to surface, it is too early to comment anything, I do believe.
I want to play this soundbite from your president because, you know, what he says, he doesn't even mention Navalny's name, many people believe, because he doesn't want to give him more legitimacy, because he actually is a thorn in Putin's side. And as I say, your government has sided with a rogue action, you know, a government using its military to force down a civilian aircraft to get a journalist. I want to play this soundbite from President Putin and have you react to it, because it flies in the face of his desire to be a responsible geopolitical leader.
The U.S. and the Russian Federation have a particular responsibility for strategic stability in the world, inasmuch as we are the two biggest nuclear powers in terms of the quantity of warheads and nuclear weapons, and also in terms of the quality of modern nuclear weaponry.
How can President Putin be a responsible geopolitical strategic leader and, you know, it flies in the face of international conventions, what he does about Navalny and indeed his decision to support that action in Belarus?
Well, I haven't seen that anyone from our government has said that they have supported action in the air of Belarus. What we are saying basically is Belarus, it is our ally, and if it will suffer economically or from the other point of view, of course we will be supportive. So that's the issue. As for the nuclear situation, yes, we feel the responsibility as well as Americans do. During Gorbachev-Reagan time, we have had about 15,000 of nuclear warhead each other on each, okay, each side. Now it has been down by 1,500, but it is still sufficient and big amounts of nuclear warheads, of course.
Ambassador Andrei Kellin, thank you so much for joining us. We're really happy to have had you to explain this new environment. Thank you so much. Now to New York, the biggest city in America, where voters are deciding who will steer them out of the pandemic as they cast ballots in the mayoral primaries. The Democratic winner may not be known for weeks, but whoever that is all but guaranteed to become mayor in the November election. There are more than a dozen candidates vying for a role that comes with far-reaching powers and an impact that can often be felt nationally. Correspondent Athena Jones gives us the state of the race in this report.
I hope you consider voting me number one.
Hopefully I'm earning your number one vote.
I look for your vote for number one.
Ranked choice voting.
Hey, NYC voters. As you may already know, New York City is introducing ranked choice voting,
seeing its first big test in New York City's Democratic mayoral race.
I think it's going to help our campaign.
Unlike past elections, instead of picking just one candidate, primary voters will be able to rank up to five in order of preference.
I love ranked choice voting, and I hope it's the future of democracy, not just in New York City, but around the country.
It's a complicated process.
Here's how it works. If no candidate wins more than 50% of the vote of first choice ballots, the candidate with the least support is eliminated. Their votes reallocated to their voters' second choice candidates. The process continues until someone wins a majority of votes.
Maya Wiley is our number one pick.
Supporters say this allows voters to have more say over who is actually elected, while avoiding expensive and time-consuming runoffs.
I'm a proponent of ranked choice voting. I co-chaired the campaign to bring it because I believe in democracy, and I believe in empowering the voice of people.
New York City launched a $15 million voter education plan in April, including community outreach and TV ads in 14 languages.
Ahora tiene la opción de clasificar hasta cinco de sus candidatos favoritos.
Some voters say they're ready.
I think ranked choice voting is a phenomenal idea.
But
you really have to read through, you have to read up on it.
The new system has made assessing the state of the race challenging.
It's much harder because you have to go through multiple rounds in order to determine who would come out as the winner with 50%+ of the vote. The reason there are 13 people running for mayor right now is nobody has an incentive to drop out. Everybody thinks that there's some path to victory because if they're everybody's second choice magically, they could in fact end up placing respectably or even winning.
It also means having a strategy.
How are you handling the sort of strategizing around it?
Don't try and strategize. But we are going to be everyone's number one. And if we don't have your number one, we want your number two.
With such a crowded field and no one candidate expected to win a majority in the first round, being someone's second or third choice and so on matters.
If you desire to do other candidates, that's fine. Make me your second choice. But I keep it simple. Eric Adams is your first choice.
If I'm not one, then two. I'm good with that.
The winner of this race is heavily favored in November's general election. Still,
this very large, unprecedented experiment in ranked choice voting is going to be handled by the New York Board of Elections, which has a reputation for screwing up big changes. So I think this is going to take a while.
Errol Lewis, New York, a New York broadcaster, ending Athena Jones' report there. And now I'm joined by Christine Quinn, the former speaker of the New York City Council who ran for mayor back in 2013, and public radio broadcaster Brian Lehrer, who's interviewed all the leading candidates on his Brian Lehrer show for WNYC. Welcome both of you to the program. Could I just have you both weigh in on what we just heard from Athena and what's happening for the first time in your city, this system of, you know, first, second, third choice. Christine Quinn, you once ran for mayor. Is this a good system?
You know, for me, the jury's out. It has great promise, but I want to see what happens at the end of the day because I am actually concerned about the New York City Board of Elections' ability to pull it off. Now, that said, so far we see good things. The most diverse candidates we've ever had run for mayor, three women, the most ever, and two of them are in the top four right now, really in the hunt to win. So I think it looks promising, but, you know, I'm a skeptical New Yorker. I want to see the proof in a couple of weeks, which, by the way, is ridiculous. They have to figure out a way to count these ballots and the rounds more quickly.
Okay, so that's interesting. Brian, you take the pulse of the people all the time. You talk to all the candidates on your program, a wonderful show. What do you think about this, but also about who's in pole position and why it is that Eric Adams seems to be, leading the pack right now?
Well, I agree, Christiane, with everything that Christine said about the pros and cons of ranked choice voting. As to Eric Adams, I think there's a big question in the city right now as to whether this is a social justice moment or whether it's a crackdown on crime moment. And they may not be counterposed because Adams is doing the best in the recent polling among Black voters. So obviously, if, as some people have put it, you're afraid of the cops and the robbers, you might want somebody who's going to kind of crack down on both bad cops and civilian crime. And Eric Adams is running in that way. His main progressive challenger, Maya Wiley, is running more on a long-term root causes of poverty and inequality, which affect civilian crime. And I think voters are choosing, those aren't the only two main candidates in the race, but voters, I think, are asking them, is this a social justice moment or is this a crackdown on crime movement, and are they necessarily opposed to each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think that adds to his resume, if you will, on cracking down on crime, that he was a police officer, rose to the very high rank of captain. I think Brian's right that it's kind of these two prongs at the moment. And of the top four candidates, Maya Wiley is definitely the progressive candidate, and Garcia, Yang, and Adams are the three moderate candidates. And I think we may see in this election a statement about what is the future of the Democratic Party going into 2022, based on not just who wins, but how the 1-2-3-4s all shake out.
Well, look, I just want to follow up, and I'll ask you both about this, because, look, it seemed that 2020 and 2021 were potentially progressive years. We saw it in the presidential election, and then they voted for the more moderate, or those who've got a lot of progressive agenda, you know, Joe Biden. Maya Wiley, who you're talking about, is number four in right now of the four that you mentioned, and quite significantly lacking. Why do you think, Christine, first, that crime seems to be a bigger, more potent issue for New Yorkers than social justice and progressive issues?
Well, I think New Yorkers see crime and police community relations together. So I think it's not quite the choice that we're talking about, even though I do see that as a potential. I think New Yorkers fear the quote unquote bad old days, right? When the Bronx was burning and crime was so high, it bears no resemblance to today. And some of the campaign rhetoric, in my opinion, has been fear-mongering. And I think it puts those images back in people's minds and they become, you know, afraid and react out of fear.
Brian, it may be fear-mongering, but the statistics are really quite shocking. There is a crime spike in New York. Homicides apparently up 53% over the last 2 years. Shootings up by more than 100%. 40% of New Yorkers believing crime is the most important issue in this year's election. As we've said, Eric Adams was in the police force. He's the Brooklyn Borough Council president right now. And he does not support defund the police or reallocating funds in any which way. Can you tell us why New York City is in the grip of this crime wave? Why?
Well, there is a crime wave in cities across America. There's a Washington Post article out just today about how mayors around the country have limited choices in dealing with the spike in crime. But to Christine's point about there being fear-mongering, I think we have to look at this in relation to what people call the bad old days, 1970s through the very early 90s, and see that we are still so far below that. And when the effects of the pandemic ease, it may well go back to a moment of continued reduction on crime with the policies that were already in place. I also want to point out that I think we're less a city divided by race on this, as some might casually assume, as we are a city divided by age. You know, you mentioned the bad old days. If you look at the major Marist poll that came out about a week ago, Maya Wiley comes in first, the progressive candidate, among people under 45. Eric Adams only comes in tied for third among under 45, but Adams comes in first among the over 45s in New York City. And these are pretty consistent across racial lines. So I think, as in some other things in politics in this country, we are a city divided by age.
Okay, so that's really interesting. And I want to ask Christine her view of a fairly, I think, quite controversial comment that Eric Adams made along racial issues. And we're, of course, in the Black Lives Matter moment, and all sorts of things are happening. But because two of the candidates, Catherine Garcia and Andrew Yang, he's the former presidential candidate, chose to campaign together, you know, Eric Adams sort of tried to equate this joint campaigning to a sort of racial voter suppression effort. Just listen to this. I just want you to react to it.
African-Americans are very clear on voter suppression. We know about a poll tax. We know about the fight that we've had historically, how you had to go through hurdles to vote. And so if they feel, based on their perception, that it suppressed the vote, then I respect their feelings. It's not for me to interpret their feelings.
So, you know, he's sort of evoking things that are happening in Republican-run. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Christine. What do you make of that comment?
Sorry, I think that comment is outrageous. You know, this is ranked choice voting. People, it was meant to engender things like candidates campaigning together. And one of the candidates is a man of color, the other a woman who was adopted into a biracial family. And to equate that appropriate get out the vote work and energy to poll taxes and things that would never happen in New York City and that no Democrat running for mayor would ever support is outrageous. It's a distortion of what happened, and it's exactly why people get driven away from electoral politics. Eric knows better. I have a lot of respect for Eric Adams, but that comment did not earn him more respect.
Let's move on to other issues that really do affect New York and New Yorkers. And that, of course, is the economy, employment, and all the rest. A recent survey and a recent article shows that it has lost more jobs than any other major U.S. city during the pandemic. 10.9% in May, the city's unemployment was nearly twice the national average, which stands at about 5.8%. So how much is this economic recovery driving voters? Brian, what are you hearing from them?
Well, I want to add first to what Christine was just saying about the claim of voter suppression along racial lines, and just say that Maya Wiley, who again is the progressive candidate in the race, the main progressive candidate, and she's also a Black woman and a civil rights attorney by trade, she also said, "This may be many things, but it is not voter suppression when there is such real voter suppression going on in a whole bunch of states in the land today." So I think it's important and interesting to know that even Maya Wiley, Eric Adams' other main opponent, but another African-American and civil rights attorney, did want to distance herself from that claim. As for the economy, New York took a bigger hit than most of the country. It is starting to come back. I think that it's recovering fairly well. Different sectors are recovering differently, but I think there's a lot of optimism about the economy in the city right now. I think they're already starting to see more tourists return to New York with confidence that it is a post-pandemic city, at least for this summer, than was expected a little while ago. So you would think that economics and long-term inequality, to come back to that, might have been top of mind for people. But I think people are in large measure assuming the economy is going to come back at least in the way that it was growing before the pandemic. And then how much they want to deal with structural inequality is a major aspect of this race, but one that has gotten kind of subsumed by the crime debate.
Mm. So, Christine, to you on that, because we also hear that maybe people are hopeful, maybe eventually the economy will get back to where it was. But a lot of it depends, doesn't it, on how much actual people want to go back to office blocks in Midtown and how much they want to work from home or work there, how that affects the surrounding businesses, et cetera, et cetera. What do you make of that? Do you think employees will continue to have the right to stay home? I know some companies are trying to urge, if not, I can't use the word force, but encourage employees to actually come into the office. What do you think the future is?
You know, I think the future on working from home or in the office is going to be mixed and maybe very different industry by industry. We're seeing the financial sector really push, maybe on the verge of force, people to come into the office. Obviously, the tech sector is very different, was already fairly remote, really moving in that direction. I do think the critical thing we're going to see, though, is flexibility. I know even at the not-for-profit that I run, WIN, we have built flexibility into our hiring in a way that might not have been there before. So I think that's going to be critical, and also listening to employees as they express what they need and they don't need. And I think the thing about the recovery is, Brian is right, it is happening. And I think that is giving the city a big boost, and hopefully then giving us the bandwidth to look at where we were deficient in the economy before. You know, at WIN, which is an organization that helps homeless families, 25% of our homeless mothers lost their jobs in the pandemic. That's a huge hit to somebody who's trying to get out of shelter and get into permanent housing. They didn't have the best jobs to begin with. So our goal needs to be to get that part of the working economy back to work in even better jobs, because then we're really going to see New York fully back, fully in a robust way that brings all of our energy and positivity back.
Thank you so much, Christine Quinn, Brian Lehrer. And of course, as we said, so many of these issues affect so many other cities and states across the country. So New York is a very important metropolis to focus on. Thanks a lot. Broadening out now across the nation, the hardening divisions between Republicans and Democrats are impacting everything from the economy to infrastructure to voting rights, as we've just been mentioning. George Will, one of the country's most well-known libertarian conservative journalists, has been following that evolution for decades. And here he is now with our Walter Isaacson discussing his take on the current state of the nation.
Thank you, Christian. And George Will, welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
This week, Congress is debating various voting rights proposals. You called one of them, you called the Democratic proposal, the For the People Act, constitutional desecration. Why are you so against it?
Well, first of all, the Constitution's fairly clear that the primary responsibility for conducting elections rests with state legislatures. And there's no particularly compelling reason to change that. There is a lot of, I think, synthetic hysteria on the left about the voting bills passed around the country as voter suppression bills. A great many of the measures that are being passed are simply going back to the status quo ante, that is, status quo before the extra measures taken in to liberalize voting procedures because of the pandemic. So there's, as I said, there's a lot of, I think people are more alarmed by the voting bills than there are people reading the voting bills. I noticed when the Major League Baseball decided to move the All-Star game from Atlanta to Denver, I predicted to some friends of mine in Major League Baseball that it would take about 10 minutes for journalists to find in Colorado voting provisions that are more restrictive, if you will, than the voting provisions, some of the voting provisions in Georgia. And 10 minutes is about how long it took.
Well, you say it's constitutional desecration because some of these bills would determine how states can run elections. But I remember you once wrote that the 1965 Voting Rights Act was one of the noblest and best things Congress had ever done. Wasn't that also determining how elections should be run in states?
Sure it was. And it was to address an egregious century-long post-Civil War violation of the spirit of the 14th Amendment, and I believe the letter of the 14th Amendment. That's a very different situation than we are today, which although advocates of H.R. 1 and S.1, the two bills in question here, say this is the resurrection of Jim Crow. That is, as I say, people go from 0 to 60 hysteria in about 10 minutes in today's political discourse.
But do you think that there's been hysteria on the Republican side as well, trying to pass these new restrictive laws in state legislatures?
Well, first of all, the use of the word restrictive is bothersome. People say, well, for example, to require a voter ID procedure is restrictive. If so, I think every member of the European Union, save Britain, is restrictive in that regard. I think that's just a a loose way of talking. But yes, my Lord, there's a Niagara of nonsense on the Republican side about voter fraud, of which there's vanishingly small evidence. In part because, if you just think about this as an economist would, the effort that has to go into organizing voter fraud on a large scale is disproportionate to any probable electoral outcome. It's just an absurd in theory and non-existent in practice. So yes, there's hysteria all around, but again, what else is new?
Senator Joe Manchin, who's our great swing senator apparently these days, has a bill this week that tries to compromise on the whole voting issue. And it includes, as you suggested, should some voter ID provisions. It also has voter security. On the other hand, it has more easy ways for people to vote, to register, and to vote early. Do you think that compromise makes sense, and is a compromise possible here?
I think it does, and I think it is possible. I would quibble with just a little bit. I don't think Manchin is the swing senator. I think there are a whole lot of Democratic senators, half a dozen at least, who are prospering in his shadow. That is, they agree with him, but they don't want to get out front and center and expose themselves to the abuse from progressives. Yes, I think a compromise is possible on this. You know, almost everything in politics is a realm of splittable differences. How much should we subsidize soybeans? Should we subsidize soybeans? I mean, we can split differences on almost everything, and I would think on election procedures as well. The one thing that I think that any voter reform should have in mind is we want decisiveness quickly in our elections. That is, if votes have to be in and tabulated late on election night, because a great nation simply cannot wander along for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks while votes are tabulated, because it was somehow too much to ask of voters that they get their vote in on time.
One of the provisions in Senator Manchin's proposal would try to reduce the amount of gerrymandering, or gerrymandering as it should be pronounced, that's been around for more than 200 years. Does that make sense? Have we gone too far where politicians of both parties are protecting themselves by drawing these weird-looking districts?
Yeah, some of the districts look like roadkill, splattered all over the map. There's a phrase in current use that makes me laugh or wince both every time I say partisan gerrymandering. All gerrymandering is inherently partisan. Both parties do it. The Supreme Court has correctly thrown up its hands when asked to come up with a metric by which we can determine what is acceptable and what is not acceptable, what crosses the line, what line, who drew it, where is it. It seems to me drawing district lines is one of the spoils of victory, and both parties are going to enjoy those spoils for the foreseeable future because the court will not rescue this.
President Trump ran a $1 trillion deficit during a time of full employment. Do you think that Republicans have abandoned the notion of fiscal responsibility more than they should have?
When did they adhere to it? I mean, it's been a very long time. People always say we must not make a fetish of balanced budgets. Good Lord. That ended, if there was such a fetishization of balanced budget, many decades ago. Waller, there are two rules. The first rule of economics is scarcity is real. Therefore, hard choices have to be made. The first rule of politics is ignore the first rule of economics. And both parties subscribe to this. The Democrats now subscribe to monetary theory. They believe it and praise it. Monetary theory says when interest rates are low and are apt to remain low, big asterisk there, a nation can borrow without limits, which means spend without limits, as long as the interest rate is lower than the rate of economic growth. Republicans criticize modern monetary theory and practice it also. We talk about the discord in American life, and Lord knows it's real enough. But I am much more alarmed by a consensus. It's a consensus as broad as the Republic, as deep as the Grand Canyon. It extends from Elizabeth Warren to Ted Cruz, and it is this. We should have a large, omnipresent, omnipotent welfare state and not pay for it. Everyone's agreed on that. Therefore, both political parties, the political class is more united by its class interest than it is divided by ideology. The class interest is to continue giving the American people a dollar's worth of government goods and services and charging it 80 cents for it. The public loves it. The political class loves it. Everybody loves it except the unconsenting, because unborn future generations are going to have to pay for all this borrowing.
And so what's our way out of that morass?
Probably a crisis, a general loss of faith in the reliability of the American dollar and the government, the government's willingness to pay its bills, or alternatively, inflation as a way of slow motion repudiation of debts. That's what inflation actually is. It is repudiation. You pile up debts in 2021 dollars, pay them off in 2031 dollars that are worth a lot less.
How worried are you about K through 12 education, the teaching of various new ways of looking at race in America?
Very worried about it. And it seems to me that's the sleeper political issue of 2022 and 2024. Enough parents, I think, are alarmed when their third grader comes home and says they're ashamed of, that their white skin puts them in an oppressor group. I think when their fifth grader comes home and says they've been studying gender fluidity in the fifth grade, I think parents are going to push back. We have a long history in this country, most famously in Dayton, Tennessee, in the Scopes trial, when in fact high school, particularly curricula, becomes a political football, another arena for the culture wars.
Do you think, though, that this has been ginned up on both sides, really, trying to push a culture war into the schools, and in fact, it's probably not one of the top 50 problems we face in this country?
I think it's a serious problem. It's certainly in the top 50, I'm concerned. It seems to me when you have a concerted effort to convince the rising generation of Americans that their nation is defined by a sin, that is white supremacy and racism, that is an important development, to put it mildly. A nation that cannot produce an educated population that rather likes their country and respects it and sees the drama of its attempts to reach a more perfect union. That's a serious problem, much bigger, frankly, than most of the problems that people argue about.
One of the arguments is about whether or not there is systemic racism. Your colleague Michael Gerson just wrote a column this week saying from a conservative viewpoint, he really understands the concept that there are things baked into our system that provide headwinds, that provide disadvantages to people of color and to blacks. Do you believe there is some racism baked into our system of economy and laws that needs to be addressed?
I do not believe that. I believe that the 64 and 65 Civil Rights Acts, dealing with public accommodations and access to the polls, I think the enormous body of law that has been developed concerning the what equality of opportunity means and is still evolving is addressing the long legacy of slavery. But the idea that is baked into the idea of equity now, that any disparity of social outcome must be, is entailed by systemic racism, is an attempt to win an argument by semantic fiat. There's far more denunciation of systemic racism than there is defining of that term.
But isn't some of the inequity in our society possibly part of a system that still has some legacies of people like yourself and myself and Mike Gerson, who grew up in affluent white neighborhoods and had more advantages?
Sure. But I don't see why we should call that racism. it may be a legacy of slavery, but it is not an example of current racism. There is a huge difference.
And so how would you redefine it so that we could address it?
I wouldn't redefine. I don't think it's a helpful term, and I would stop using it.
Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court has been trying to do a delicate balance between free speech rights, rights of gays and other people, as well as freedom of religion. They balanced it a bit this past week when it came to a case about foster care and Catholic services. How do you think that balance should go?
I think there's an enormous amount of bullying now going on over the free exercise of religion. That fellow at the Masterpiece Bakery in Colorado is still being harassed by people who want him to bake cakes that for occasions that violate his sense of religious propriety, same-sex marriages, whatever. Now, there is no shortage in the Denver area of bakeries willing to bake these cakes. Why don't they just leave the man alone? The rapid, swift, altogether welcome triumph of the gay rights movement it is in danger of stepping over into now in a kind of aggressive, triumphalist bullying on the part of the victors. Gay rights are now firmly protected in law, firmly supported by a majority opinion in the United States. Leave the baker alone. Enjoy the fruits of victory. Let's everybody calm down and let that little live and let live spirit, which was originally what the gay rights movement was all about.
The latest affirmative action case that'll probably reach the court, one of them involves Harvard and potential discriminations against Asian Americans because of preferences in the admissions process, or allegedly so, that prefer blacks and other minorities. Why should Harvard be told by the government how to pick and choose the people for the classes it wants to educate?
Well, that's a good question, because the court has said that schools have enormous latitude to shape their student bodies for academic reasons that they think serve the learning experience. I got that. During the discovery in the lower courts about this particular case that is wending its way toward the Supreme Court, a document was unearthed from the Harvard admissions department that said the following: if admissions were simply by the two objective metrics, that is high school transcripts and standardized tests, the admissions at Harvard would be 40% Asian American and 1% African American. Now, that's not an outcome Harvard wants, and Harvard should be, it seems to me, should enjoy some latitude to prevent that. On the other hand, Harvard, which is, shall we say, friendly to the progressive impulse in the United States, has been a cheerleader for a central government that fine-tunes the behavior of civil society's institutions in order to bring them into conformity with non-discrimination laws. So Harvard is going to have to find a way to live with the laws that most of us like.
George Will, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
I've enjoyed it. Let's do it again.
The conservative take of George Will. And finally tonight, blazing trails in the sporting world this Pride Month. Carl Nassib becomes the first openly gay active NFL player in the league's 101-year history. The Las Vegas Raiders defensive linesman made this announcement on Instagram.
I've been meaning to do this for a while now, but I finally feel comfortable enough to get it off my chest. I really have the best life. I got the best family, friends, and job a guy could ask for. I'm a pretty private person, so I hope you guys know that I'm really not doing this for attention. I just think that representation and visibility are so important. I actually hope that, like, one day videos like this and the whole coming out process are just not necessary. But until then, you know, I'm going to do my best and do my part to cultivate a culture that's accepting, that's compassionate.
And he's had support from across the league. The NFL says it's proud Nasib is, quote, courageously sharing his truth. Nasib says he will donate $100,000 to the Trevor Project, which is the leading suicide prevention organization for LGBTQ youth in the United States. On the other side of the world, New Zealand has selected the first transgender athlete to compete in the Olympic Games. Weightlifter Laurel Hubbard will be part of the national team at the Tokyo Summer Games. History being made on the pitch and on the mat. And that is it for our program tonight. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London. See you tomorrow night.